edge and slammed the door of the captain's cabin behind him. He made it halfway to the bed before the shaking hit him, and then all he could do was sink down on his knees.
Light, what game am I playing in? I have to know the game if I'm going to win. Light, what game?
Playing Rose of the Morning softly on his flute, Rand peered into his campfire, where a rabbit was roasting on a stick slanting over the flames. A night wind made the flames flicker. He barely noticed the smell of the rabbit, though a vagrant thought did come that he needed to find more salt in the next village or town. Rose of the Morning was one of the tunes he had played at those weddings.
How many days ago was that? Were there really so many, or did I imagine it? Every woman in the village deciding to marry at once? What was its name? Am I going mad already?
Sweat beaded on his face, but he played on, barely loud enough to be heard, staring into the fire. Moraine had told him he was Taviren. Everyone said he was Taviren. Maybe he really was. People like that changed things around them. A Taviren might have caused all those weddings, but that was too close to something he did not want to think about.
They say I'm the dragon reborn, too. They all say it. The living say it and the dead. That doesn't make it true. I had to let them proclaim me. Duty. I had no choice. But that does not make it true.
He could not seem to stop playing that one tune. It made him think of Egwene. He had thought once that he would marry Egwene. A long time ago, that seemed. That was gone, now. She had come in his dreams, though.
It might have been her. Her face. It was her face.
Only there had been so many faces. Faces he knew. Tam and his mother and Matt and Perrin. All trying to kill him. It had not really been them, of course. Only their faces on Shadow Spawn. He thought that it had not really been them. Even in his dreams, it seemed the Shadow Spawn walked. Were they only dreams? Some dreams were real, he knew, and others were only dreams. Nightmares or hopes. But how to tell the difference? Min had walked his dreams one night and tried to plant a knife in his back. He was still surprised at how much that had pained him. He had been careless, let her come close, let down his guard. Around Min, he had not felt any need to be on his guard in so long, despite the things she saw when she looked at him. Being with her had been like having balm soothed into his wounds.
And then she tried to kill me.
The music rose to a discordant screech, but he pulled it back to softness.
Not her. Shadow Spawn with her face. Least of them all would Min hurt me.
He could not understand why he thought that, but he was sure it was true. So many faces in his dreams. Celine had come, cool and mysterious, and so lovely his mouth went dry just thinking of her, offering him glory as she had, so long ago it seemed. But now it was the sword she said he had to take. And with the sword would come Celine. Kalandor. That was always in his dreams. Always. And taunting faces. Hands, pushing Egwene and Nynaeve and Elaine into cages, snaring them in nets, hurting them. Why should he weep more for Elaine than for the other two? His head spun. His head hurt as much as his side, and sweat rolled down his face, and he softly played Rose of the Morning through the night, fearing to sleep, fearing to dream. Chapter 33. Within the Weave. From his saddle, Perrin frowned down at the flat stone half hidden in weeds by the roadside. This road of hard-packed dirt, already called the Lugard Road, now they were near the Manetherendrell, and the border of Murundi, had been paved once, long in the past, so Moraine had said 2 days earlier, and bits of paving stone still worked their way to the surface from time to time. This one had an odd marking on it. If dogs had been able to make footprints on stone, he would have said it was the print of a large hound. There were no hound's footprints in any of the bare ground he could see, where softer dirt on the verge might take one, and no smell of any dog's trail. Just a faint trace in the air of something burned, almost the sulfurous smell left by setting off fireworks. There was a town ahead, where the road struck the river. Maybe some children had sneaked out here with some of the illuminator's handiwork. A long way yet for children to sneak. But he had seen farms. It could have been farm children. Whatever it is, it has nothing to do with that marking. Horses don't fly and dogs don't make footprints on stone. I'm getting too tired to think straight. Yawning, he dug his heels into Stepper's ribs and the dun broke into a gallop after the others. Moraine had been pushing them hard since leaving Jara, and there was no waiting for anyone who stopped for even a moment. When the Aes Sedai put her mind on something, she was as hard as cold hammered iron. Loyal had given up reading as he rode 6 days earlier, after looking up to find himself left a mile behind and everyone else almost out of sight over the next hill. Perrin slowed Stepper alongside the Ogier's big horse, behind Moraine's white mare, and yawned again. Lan was up ahead somewhere, scouting. The sun behind them stood no more than an hour above the treetops, but the warder had said they would reach a town called Remen, on the Manetheran Drell, before dark. Perrin was not sure he wanted to see what awaited them there. He did not know what it might be, but the day since Jara had made him wary.
"I don't see why you can't sleep," Loyal had told him. "I am so tired by the time she lets us halt for the night, I fall asleep before I can lie down."
Perrin only shook his head. There was no way to explain to Loyal that he did not dare sleep soundly, that even his lightest sleep was full of troubled dreams. Like that odd one with Egwene and Hopper in it. Well, no wonder I dream about her. Light, I wonder how she is. Safe in the tower by now and learning how to be Aes Sedai. Varen will look after her, and after Matt, too. He did not think anyone needed to look after Nynaeve. Around Nynaeve, to his mind, other people needed someone to look after them. He did not want to think about Hopper. He was succeeding in keeping live wolves out of his head, although at the price of feeling as if he had been hammered and drawn by a hasty hand. He did not want to think a dead wolf might be creeping in. He shook himself and forced his eyes wide open. Not even Hopper. There had been more reasons than bad dreams not to sleep well. They had found other signs left by Rand's passage. Between Jara and the River Burn, there had been none Perrin could see, but when they crossed the burn, by a stone bridge arching from 150-foot river cliff to another, they had left behind a town called Sidon, all in ashes. Every building. Only a few stone walls and chimneys still stood among the ruins. Bedraggled townspeople said a lantern dropped in a barn had started it, and then the fire seemed to run wild. And everything went wrong. Half the buckets that could be found had holes in them. Every last burning wall had fallen outward instead of in, setting houses to either side alight. Flaming timbers from the inn had somehow tumbled as far as the main well in the square, so no one could draw more water from it to fight the fires, and houses had fallen right on top of three other wells. Even the wind had seemed to shift, fanning the flames in every direction. There had been no need to ask Moraine if Rand's presence had caused it. Her face, like cold iron, was answer enough. The pattern shaped itself around Rand, and chance ran wild. Beyond Sidon, they had ridden through four small towns where only Lan's tracking told them Rand was still ahead. Rand was afoot now, and had been for some time. They had found his horse, back beyond Jara, dead, looking as if it had been mauled by wolves or dogs run wild. It had been hard for Perrin not to reach out then, especially when Moraine looked up from the horse to frown at him. Luckily, Lan had found the tracks of Rand's boots, running from where the dead horse lay. One boot heel had a three-cornered gouge from a rock. It made his prints plain. But afoot or mounted, he seemed to be staying ahead of them. In the four villages after Sidon, the biggest excitement anyone could remember was seeing Loyal ride in and discovering that he was an Ogier. For real and for true. They were so caught up with that they barely even noticed Perrin's eyes, and when they did, well, if Ogier were real, then men could very well have any color eyes at all. But after those came a little place named Willar, and it was celebrating. The spring on the village common was flowing again. After a year of hauling water a mile from a stream when all efforts at digging wells had failed, and half the people had moved away, Willar would not die after all. Three more untouched villages had been followed in quick succession, all in one day, by Samaha, where every well in town had gone dry just the night before, and people were muttering about the Dark One. Then Tallinn, where all the old arguments the village had ever known, had bubbled to the surface like overflowing cesspits a morning earlier. And it had taken three murders to shock everyone back to his senses. And finally, Fiol, where the crops this spring looked to be the poorest anyone could remember. But the mayor, digging a new privy behind his house, had found rotted leather sacks full of gold, so no one would go hungry. No one in Fiol recognized the fat coins, with a woman's face on one side and an eagle on the other. Moraine said they had been minted in Manetherin. Perrin had finally asked her about it as they sat around their campfire one night. After Jara, I thought, they were all so happy with their weddings. Even the white cloaks were only made to look like fools. Fiol was all right. Rand couldn't have had anything to do with their crops. They were failing before he ever came. And that gold was surely good with their need. But all this other, that town burning and the wells failing, and that is evil, Moraine. I can't believe Rand is evil. The pattern may be shaping itself around him, but how can the pattern be that evil? It makes no sense, and things have to make sense. If you make a tool with no sense to it, it's wasted metal. The pattern wouldn't make waste. Land gave him a wry look and vanished into the darkness to make a circuit around their campsite. Loyal, already stretched out in his blankets, lifted his head to listen, ears pricking forward. Moraine was silent for a time, warming her hands. Finally she spoke while staring into the flames.
The Creator is good, Perrin. The Father of Lies is evil. The pattern of age, the age lace itself, is neither. The pattern is what is. The wheel of time weaves all lives into the pattern, all actions. A pattern that is all one color is no pattern. For the pattern of an age, good and ill, are the warp and the woof.
Even riding through late afternoon sunshine 3 days later, Perrin felt the chill he had had on first hearing her say those words. He wanted to believe the pattern was good. He wanted to believe that when men did evil things, they were going against the pattern, distorting it. To him, the pattern was a fine and intricate creation made by a master smith. That it mixed pot metal and worse in with good steel, with never a care, was a cold thought.
I care, he muttered softly. Light, I do care.
Moraine glanced back at him and he fell silent. He was not sure what the Aes Sedai cared about beyond Rand. A few minutes later, Lan appeared from ahead and swung his black warhorse in beside Moraine's mare.
Remen lies just over the next hill, he said. They have had an eventful day or two, it seems.
Loyal's ears twitched once.
Rand?
The warder shook his head.
I do not know. Perhaps Moraine can say when she sees.
The Aes Sedai gave him a searching look, then heeled her white mare to a quicker step. They topped the hill and Remen lay spread out below them, hard against the river. The Manetherin Drell stretched more than half a mile wide here, and there was no bridge, though two crowded barge-like ferries crept across, propelled by long oars, and one nearly empty was returning. Three more shared long stone docks with nearly a dozen river traders' vessels, some with one mast, some with two. A few bulky, gray stone warehouses separated the docks from the town itself, where the buildings seemed mostly of stone as well, though roofed in tiles of every color from yellow to red to purple, and the streets ran every which way around a central square. Moraine pulled up the deep hood of her cloak to hide her face before they rode down. As usual, the people in the streets stared at Loyal, but this time Perrin heard awed murmurs of, "Ogier." Loyal sat straighter in his saddle than he had in some time, and his ears stood straight and a smile just curled the ends of his wide mouth.
He was obviously trying not to let on that he was pleased, but he looked like a cat having its ears scratched. Remen looked like any of a dozen towns to Perrin. It was full of man-made aromas and man-smell, with a strong smell of the river, of course. And he was wondering what Lan could have meant when the hair on the back of his neck stirred as he scented something wrong. As soon as his nose took it in, it was gone, like a horsehair dropped onto hot coals, but he remembered it. He had smelled the same smell at Jara, and it had vanished the same way then. It was not a twisted one or a neverborn. Trolloc, burn me, not a twisted one. Not a neverborn, a murdrol, a fade, a half-man. Anything but a neverborn. Not a trolloc or a fade, yet the stench had been every bit as sharp, every bit as vile. But whatever gave off that scent left no lasting trail, it seemed. They rode into the town square. One of the big paving blocks had been pried up right in the middle of the square, so a gibbet could be erected. A single thick timber rose out of the dirt, supporting a braced crosspiece from which hung an iron cage, the bottom of it 4 paces high. A tall man, dressed all in grays and browns, sat in the cage, holding his knees under his chin. He had no room to do otherwise. 3 small boys were pitching stones at him. The man looked straight ahead, not flinching when a stone made it between the bars. More than one trickle of blood stained his face. The townspeople walking by paid no more mind to what the boys were doing than the man did, though every last one of them looked at the cage, most of them with approval, and some with fear. Moraine made a sound in her throat that might have been disgust. "There is more," Lan said. "Come, I've already arranged rooms at an inn. I think you will find it interesting." Perrin looked back over his shoulder at the caged man as he rode after them. There was something familiar about the man, but he could not place it.
"They shouldn't do that," Loyal's rumble sounded halfway to a snarl. "The children, I mean. The grown-ups should stop them."
"They should," Perrin agreed, barely paying attention. "Why is he familiar?" The sign over the door of the inn Lan led them to, nearer the river, read Wayman's Forge, which Perrin took for a good omen, though there seemed to be nothing of the smithy about the place, except the leather-aproned man with a hammer painted on the sign. It was a large, purple-roofed, 3-story building of squared and polished gray stones with large windows and scroll-carved doors, and it had a prosperous look. Stablemen came running to take the horses, bowing even more deeply after Lan tossed them coins. Inside, Perrin stared at the people. The men and women at the tables were all dressed in their feast-day clothes, it seemed to him, with more embroidered coats, more lace on dresses, more colored ribbons and fringed scarves than he had seen in a long time. Only 4 men sitting at 1 table wore plain coats, and they were the only ones who did not look up expectantly when Perrin and the others walked in. The 4 men kept on talking softly. He could make out a little of what they were saying, about the virtues of ice peppers over furs as cargo, and what the troubles in Saldaea might have done to prices. Captains of trading ships, he decided. The others seemed to be local folk. Even the serving women appeared to be wearing their best, their long aprons covering embroidered dresses with bits of lace at the neck. The kitchen was working heavily. He could smell mutton, lamb, chicken, and beef, as well as some sort of vegetables, and a spicy cake that made him forget meat for a moment. The innkeeper himself met them just inside, a plump, bald-headed man with shining brown eyes and a smooth pink face, bowing and dry-washing his hands. If he had not come to them, Perrin would never have taken him for the landlord, for instead of the expected white apron, he wore a coat like everyone else, all white and green embroidery on stout blue wool that had the man sweating with its weight. "Why are they all wearing clothes for festival?" Perrin wondered.
"Ah, Master Andra," the innkeeper said, addressing Lan. "And an ogier, just as you said. Not that I doubted, of course, not with all that's happened, and never your word, Master. Why not an ogier?" "Ah, friend ogier, to be having you in the house gives me more pleasure than you can be knowing. 'Tis a fine thing, and a fitting cap to it all. Ah, and mistress."
His eyes took in the deep blue silk of her dress and the rich wool of her cloak, dusty from travel but still fine.
"Forgive me, lady, please."
His bow bent him like a horseshoe.
"Master Andra did not make your station clear, lady. I meant no disrespect. You are even more welcome than friend Ogier here, of course, lady. Please take no offense at Gynor Ferlin's poor tongue."
"I take none."
Moraine's voice calmly accepted the title Ferlin gave her. It was far from the first time the Aes Sedai had gone under another name, or pretended to be something she was not. It was not the first Perrin had heard Lan name himself Andra, either. The deep hood still hid Moraine's smooth Aes Sedai features, and she held her cloak around her with one hand as if taken with a chill. Not the hand in which she wore her great serpent ring.
"You have had strange occurrences in the town, innkeeper, so I understand. Nothing to trouble travelers, I trust."
"Ah, lady! You might be calling them strange indeed. Your own radiant presence is more than enough to honor this humble house, lady, and bringing an ogier with you. But we have hunters in Remen, too. Right here in Wayland's Forge they are. Hunters for the Horn of Valyr, set out from Ilion for adventure. And adventure they found, lady, here in Remen, or just a mile or two upriver, fighting wild Aielmen of all things. Can you imagine black-veiled Aiel savages in Ultara, lady?"
Aiel. Now Perrin knew what was familiar about the man in the cage. He had seen an Aiel once, one of those fierce, nearly legendary denizens of the harsh land called the Waste. The man had looked a good deal like Rand, taller than most, with gray eyes and reddish hair, and he had been dressed like the man in the cage, all in browns and grays that would fade into rock or brush, with soft boots laced to his knees. Perrin could almost hear Min's voice again.
"An Aielman in a cage, a turning point in your life, or something important that will happen.
Why do you have—" He stopped to clear his throat so he would not sound so hoarse.
"How did an Aiel come to be caged in your town square?"
"Ah, young master, that is a story to—"
Ferlin trailed off, eyeing him up and down, taking in his plain country clothes and the longbow in his hands, pausing over the axe at his belt opposite his quiver. The plump man gave a start when his study reached Perrin's face, as if, with a lady and an ogier present, he had just now noticed Perrin's yellow eyes.
"He would be your servant, Master Andra?"
he asked cautiously. "Answer him," was all Lan said.
Ah, of course, Master Andra. But here's who can tell it better than myself. 'Tis Lord Orban himself. 'Tis he we have gathered to hear."
A dark-haired youngish man in a red coat with a bandage wound around his temples was making his way down the stairs at the side of the common room, using padded crutches. The left leg of his breeches cut away so more bandages could strap his calf from ankle to knee. The townspeople murmured as if seeing something wondrous. The ship captains went on with their quiet talking. They had come round to furs. Ferlin might have thought the man in the red coat could tell the story better, but he went ahead himself.
"Lord Orban and Lord Garn faced 20 wild Aielmen with only 10 retainers. Ah! Fierce was the fighting and hard, with many wounds given and received. 6 good retainers died, and every man took hurts, Lord Orban and Lord Garn worst of all. But every Aiel they slew, save those who fled, and one they took prisoner. 'Tis that one you see out there in the square, where he'll not be troubling the countryside any more with his savage ways, no more than the dead ones will."
"You have had trouble from Aiel in this district?" Moraine asked.
Perrin was wondering the same thing, with no little consternation. If some people still occasionally used black-veiled Aiel as a term for someone violent, it was testimony to the impression the Aiel War had left. But that was 20 years in the past now, and the Aiel had never come out of the waste before or since.
"But I saw one this side of the spine of the world, and now I've seen 2.
The innkeeper rubbed at his bald head.
Ah, no, lady, not exactly. But we would have had, you can be sure, with 20 savages loose. Why, everyone remembers how they killed and looted and burned their way across Kyrian. Men from this very village marched to the Battle of the Shining Walls when the nations gathered to throw them back.
I myself suffered from a twisted back at the time, and so could not go, but I remember well, as we all do. How they came here so far from their own land, or why, I do not know. But Lord Orban and Lord Garn saved us from them.
There was a murmur of agreement from the folk in feast-day clothes. Orban himself came stumping across the common room, not seeming to see anyone but the innkeeper. Perrin could smell stale wine before he was even close.
"Where's that old woman taking herself off to with her herbs, Ferlin?" Orban demanded roughly. "Gon's wounds are paining him, and my head feels about to split open."
Ferlin almost bent his head to the floor.
Mother Leitch will be back in the morning, Lord Orban. A birthing lord. But she said she'd stitched and poulticed your wounds and Lord Garn's, so there'd be no worrying. Ah, Lord Orban, I'm sure she'll be seeing to you first thing on the morrow.
The bandaged man muttered something under his breath to any ears but Perrin's, about waiting on a farm wife, throwing her litter, and something else about being sewn up like a sack of meal. He shifted sullen, angry eyes and for the first time appeared to see the newcomers. Perrin he dismissed immediately, which did not surprise Perrin at all. His eyes widened a little at Loyal.
He's seen Ogier, Perrin thought, but he never thought to see one here.
Narrowed a bit at Lan. He knows a fighting man when he sees one, and he does not like seeing one. And brightened as he stooped to peer inside Moraine's hood, though he was not close enough to see her face. Perrin decided not to think anything at all about that, not concerning an Aes Sedai, and he hoped neither Moraine nor Lan thought anything of it either. A light in the warder's eyes told him he had missed on that hope, at least.
12 of you fought 20 Aiel? Lan asked in a flat voice.
Orban straightened, wincing. In an elaborately casual tone, he said,
Aye, you must expect things such as that when you seek the Horn of Valier. It was not the first such encounter for Garn and me, nor will it be the last before we find the horn, if the light shines on us.
He sounded as if the light could not possibly do anything else.
Not all our fights have been with Aiel, of course, but there are always those who would stop hunters if they could. Garn and I, we do not stop easily.
Another approving murmur came from the townspeople. Orban stood a little straighter.
You lost 6 and took 1 prisoner. From Lan's voice, it was not clear if that was a good exchange or a poor one.
Aye, Orban said. We slew the rest, save those who ran. No doubt they're hiding their dead now. I've heard they do that. The White Cloaks are out searching for them, but they'll never find them.
There are White Cloaks here? Perrin asked sharply.
Orban glanced at him and dismissed him once more. The man addressed Lan again.
White Cloaks always put their noses in where they are not wanted or needed. Incompetent louts, all of them. Aye, they'll ride all over the countryside for days, but I doubt they'll find as much as their own shadows.
I suppose they won't, Lan said. The bandaged man frowned as if unsure exactly what Lan meant, but rounded on the innkeeper again.
You find that old woman here. My head is splitting.
With a last glance at Lan, he hobbled away, climbing back up the stairs one at a time, followed by murmurs of admiration for a hunter of the horn who had slain Aielman.
This is an eventful town.
Loyal's deep voice drew every eye to him. Except for the ship captains, who seemed to be discussing rope, as near as Perrin could make out.
Everywhere I go, you humans are doing things. Hurrying and scurrying, having things happen to you. How can you stand so much excitement?
Ah, friend Ogier, Ferlin said. 'Tis the way of us humans to want excitement. How much I regret not being able to march to the Shining Walls. Why, let me tell you.
Our rooms?
Moraine did not raise her voice, but her words cut the innkeeper short like a sharp knife.
Andra did arrange rooms, did he not?
Ah, lady, forgive me. Yes, Master Andra did indeed hire rooms. Forgive me, please.
"'Tis all the excitement. Makes my head empty itself. Please forgive me, lady. This way, if you please. If you please to follow me?"
Bowing and scraping, apologizing and babbling without pause, Ferlin led them up the stairs. At the top, Perrin paused to look back. He heard the murmurs of Lady and Ogier down there, could feel all those eyes, but it seemed to him that he felt one pair of eyes in particular. Someone staring not at Moraine and Loyal, but at him. He picked her out immediately. For one thing, she stood apart from the others, and for another, she was the only woman in the room not wearing at least a little lace. Her dark gray, almost black dress was as plain as the ship captain's clothes, with wide sleeves and narrow skirts, and never a frill or stitch of fancy work. The dress was divided for riding, he saw when she moved, and she wore soft boots that peeked out under the hem. She was young, no older than he was, perhaps, and tall for a woman, with thick black hair to her shoulders. A nose that just missed being too large and too bold, a generous mouth, high cheekbones, and dark, slightly tilted eyes. He could not quite decide whether she was beautiful or not. As soon as he looked down, she turned to address one of the serving women and did not glance at the stairs again. But he was sure he'd been right. She had been staring at him. Chapter 34. A Different Dance. Ferlin burbled on as he showed them to their rooms, though Perrin did not really listen. He was too busy wondering if the black-haired girl knew what yellow eyes meant.
Burn me, she was looking at me.
Then he heard the innkeeper say the words,
proclaiming the dragon in Giladan,
and he thought his ears would go to sharp points like Loyal's. Moraine stopped dead in the doorway to her room.
There is another false dragon, innkeeper, in Giladan?
The hood of her cloak still hid her face, but she sounded shaken to her toes. Even listening for the man's reply, Perrin could not help staring at her. He smelled something close to fear.
Ah, lady, never you fear. 'Tis 100 leagues to Giladan, and none will trouble you here. Not with Master Andra about. And Lord Orban and Lord Gunn. Why?
Answer her, Lan said harshly. Is there a false dragon in Giladan?
No, Master Andra. Not precisely. I said there's a man proclaiming the dragon in Giladan. So we heard a few days gone. Preaching his coming, you might say. Talking about the fellow over in Taraban we've heard about. Though some do say 'tis Arad-Duman, not Taraban. A long way from here, in any case. Why, any other day I expect we'd talk more of that than anything else, except maybe the wild tales about Hawkwing's army come back.
Lan's cold eyes might as well have been knife blades from the way Ferlin swallowed and scrubbed his hands faster.
I only know what I hear, Master Andra. 'Tis said the fellow has a stare can pin you where you stand, and he talks all sorts of rubbish about the dragon coming to save us. And we all have to follow, and even the beasts will fight for the dragon. I don't know whether they've arrested him yet or not. 'Tis likely. The Giladanin would not put up long with that kind of talk.
Massima, Perrin thought wonderingly. It's bloody Massima.
You are right, innkeeper, Lan said. This fellow isn't likely to trouble us here. I know a fellow once who liked to make wild speeches. You remember him, Lady Alice, don't you? Massima?
Moraine gave a start.
Massima. Yes, of course. I had put him out of my mind.
Her voice firmed.
When next I see Massima, he will wish someone had peeled his hide to make boots.
She slammed the door behind her so hard that the crash echoed down the hallway.
Keep it quiet, came a muffled shout from the far end. My head is splitting.
Ah!
Ferlin washed his hands in one direction, then rubbed them in another.
Ah, forgive me, Master Andra, but Lady Alice is a fierce-sounding woman.
Only with those who displease her, Lan said blandly. Her bite is far worse than her bark.
Your rooms are this way. Friend Ogier, when Master Andra told me you were coming, I had an Ogier bed brought from the attic where it has been gathering dust these 300 years or more. Why, 'tis...
Perrin let the words wash over him, hearing them no more than a river rock hears the water. The black-haired young woman worried him, and the caged Aiel. Once in his own room, a small one in the back, Lan had done nothing to disabuse the innkeeper of the notion that Perrin was a servant. He moved mechanically, still wrapped in thought. He unstrung his bow and propped it in the corner, keeping it strung too long, ruined bow and string alike. Set down his blanket roll and saddlebags beside the washstand, and threw his cloak across them. He hung his belts with quiver and axe from pegs on the wall, and nearly lay down on the bed before a jaw-cracking yawn reminded him how dangerous that might be. The bed was narrow, and the mattress appeared to be all lumps. It looked more inviting than any bed he could remember. He sat on the three-legged stool instead and thought. Always he liked to think things through. After a time, Loyal rapped on the door and put his head in. The Ogier's ears practically quivered with excitement, and his grin very nearly split his broad face in two.
"Perrin, you will not believe it. My bed is sungwood. Why, it must be well over 1,000 years old. No tree singer has sung a piece so large in at least that long. I myself would not care to try it, and I have the talent more strongly than most now. Well, to be truthful, there are not many of us with the talent at all any more, but I am among the best of those who can sing wood."
"That is very interesting," Perrin said. "An Aiel in a cage. That is what Min said. Why was that girl staring at me?"
"I thought it was."
Loyal sounded a little put out that he did not share the Ogier's excitement, but all Perrin wanted to do was think.
"Supper is ready below, Perrin. They have prepared their finest in case the hunters want anything, but we can have some."
"You go on, Loyal. I'm not hungry." The smells of cooking meat floating up from the kitchen did not interest him. He hardly noticed Loyal going. Hands on his knees, yawning now and again, he tried to work it out. It seemed like one of those puzzles Master Luhan made, the metal pieces appearing to be linked inextricably. But there was always a trick to make the iron loops and whorls come apart, and there had to be here, too. The girl had been looking at him. His eyes might explain that, except that the innkeeper had ignored them, and no one else had even noticed. They had an Ogier to look at, and hunters of the horn in the house, and a lady visiting, and an Aiel caged in the square. Nothing as small as the color of a man's eyes could seize their attention. Nothing about a servant could compete with the rest. So why did she pick me to stare at? And the Aiel in the cage. What Min saw was always important, but how? What was he supposed to do? I could have stopped those children throwing rocks. I should have. It was no use telling himself the adults would certainly have told him to go on about his business, that he was a stranger in Remen, and the Aiel was none of his concern. I should have tried. No answers came to him, so he went back to the beginning and patiently worked through it once more. Then again, and again. Still he found nothing except regret for what he had not done. It came to him after a time that night had finally fallen. The room was dark except for a little moonlight through the lone window. He thought about the tallow candle in the tinderbox he had seen on the mantel over the narrow fireplace, but there was more than enough light for his eyes. I have to do something, don't I? He buckled on his axe, then paused. He had done it without thinking. Wearing the thing had become as natural as breathing. He did not like that. But he left the belt around his waist and went out. Light from the stairs made the hallway seem almost bright after his room. Talk and laughter drifted up from the common room and cooking smells from the kitchen. He strode toward the front of the inn, to Moraine's room, knocked once and went in, and stopped, his face burning. Moraine pulled the pale blue robe that hung from her shoulders around herself.
"You wish something?" she asked coolly.
She had a silver-backed hairbrush in one hand, and her dark hair, spilling down her neck in dark waves, glistened as if she had been brushing it. Her room was far finer than his, with polished wooden paneling on the walls and silver-chased lamps and a warm fire on the wide brick hearth. The air smelled of rose-scented soap. I thought Lan was here, he managed to get out. You two always have your heads together, and I thought he'd... I thought...
What do you want, Perrin?
He took a deep breath.
Is this Rand's doing?
I know Lan followed him here, and it all seems odd, the hunters and Aiel. But did he do it?
I do not think so. I will know more when Lan tells me what he discovers tonight. With luck, what he finds will help the choice I must make.
A choice?
Rand could have crossed the river and be on his way to Tyr cross-country. Or he could have taken ship downriver to Ilion, meaning to board another there for Tyr. The journey is leagues longer that way, but days faster.
I don't think we are going to catch him, Moraine. I don't know how he's doing it, but even afoot he is staying ahead of us. If Lan is right, he is still half a day ahead.
I could almost suspect he had learned to travel, Moraine said with a small frown. Except that if he had, he would have gone straight to Tyr. No, he has the blood of long walkers and strong runners in him. But we may take the river anyway. If I cannot catch him, I will be in Tyr close behind him, or waiting for him.
Perrin shifted his feet uneasily. There was cold promise in her voice.
You told me once that you could sense a dark friend, one who has far gone into the shadow, at least. Lan, too. Have you sensed anything like that here?
She gave a loud sniff and turned back to a tall standing mirror with finely made silverwork set in the legs. Holding a robe closed with one hand, she ran the brush through her hair with the other.
Very few humans are so far gone as that, Perrin, even among the worst dark friends.
The brush halted in mid-stroke.
Why do you ask?
There was a girl down in the common room staring at me. Not at you and Loyal like everybody else. At me.
The brush resumed motion, and a smile briefly touched Moraine's lips. You sometimes forget, Perrin, that you are a good-looking young man. Some girls admire a pair of shoulders.
He grunted and shuffled his feet.
Was there something else, Perrin?
No. She could not help with Min's viewing, not beyond telling him what he already knew, that it was important. And he did not want to tell her what Min had seen, or that Min had seen anything, for that matter. Back out in the hall, with the door closed, he leaned against the wall for a moment.
Light. Just walking in on her like that, and her...
She was a pretty woman.
And likely old enough to be my mother or more.
He thought Matt would probably have asked her down to the common room to dance.
No, he wouldn't. Even Matt isn't fool enough to try charming an Aes Sedai.
Moraine did dance. He had danced with her once himself, and nearly fallen over his own feet with every other step.
Stop thinking about her like a village girl just because you saw... She's bloody Aes Sedai. You have that Aiel to worry about.
He gave himself a shake and went downstairs. The common room was full as it could be, with every chair taken and stools and benches brought in, and those who had nowhere to sit standing along the walls. He did not see the black-haired girl, and no one else looked at him twice as he hurriedly crossed the room. Orban occupied a table to himself, his bandaged leg propped up on a chair with a cushion, with a soft slipper on that foot, a silver goblet in his hand, the serving women keeping it filled with wine.
Aye, he was saying to the whole room, we knew the Aiel for fierce fighters, Ghan and I, but there was no time to hesitate. I drew my sword and dug my heels into lion's ribs.
Perrin gave a start before he realized that the man meant his horse was named Lion.
Wouldn't put it past him to say he was riding a lion.
He felt a bit ashamed. Just because he did not like the man was no reason to suppose the hunter would take his boasting that far. He hurried on outside without looking back. The street in front of the inn was as crowded as inside, with people who could not find a place in the common room peering in through the windows, and twice as many huddling around the doors to listen to Orban's tale. No one glanced at Perrin twice, though his passage brought muttered complaints from those jostled a little further from the door. Everyone who was out in the night must have been at the inn, for he saw no one as he walked to the square.
Sometimes the shadow of a person moved across a lighted window, but that was all. He had the feeling of being watched, though, and looked around uneasily. Nothing but night-cloaked streets dotted with glowing windows. Around the square, most of the windows were dark, except a few on upper floors. The gibbet stood as he remembered, the man, the Aiel, still in the cage, hanging higher than he could reach. The Aiel seemed to be awake, at least his head was up, but he never looked down at Perrin. The stones the children had been throwing were scattered beneath the cage. The cage hung from a thick rope, tied to a ring on one of the upper bars, and running through a heavy pulley on the crosspiece down to a pair of stubs waist-high from the bottom of the upright on either side. The excess rope lay in a careless tangle of coils at the foot of the gibbet. Perrin looked around again, searching the dark square. He still had the feeling of being watched, but he still saw nothing. He listened and heard nothing. He smelled chimney smoke and cooking from the houses, and man sweat and the old blood from the man in the cage. There was no fear scent from him. His weight, and then there's the cage, he thought as he moved closer to the gibbet. He did not know when he had decided to do this, or even if he really had decided, but he knew he was going to do it. Hooking a leg around the heavy upright, he heaved on the rope, hoisting the cage enough to gain a little slack. The way the rope jerked told him the man in the cage had finally moved, but he was in too much of a hurry to stop and tell him what he was doing. The slack let him unwind the rope from around the stubs. Still bracing himself with his leg around the upright, he quickly lowered the cage hand over hand to the paving blocks. The Aiel was looking at him now, studying him silently. Perrin said nothing. When he got a good look at the cage, his mouth tightened. If a thing was made, even a thing like this, it should be made well. The entire front of the cage was a door, on rude hinges, made by a hasty hand, held by a good iron lock on a chain as badly wrought as the cage. He fumbled the chain around until he found the worst link, then jammed the thick spike on his axe through it. A sharp twist of his wrist forced the link open. In seconds, he separated the chain, rattled it free, and swung open the front of the cage. The Aiel sat there, knees yet under his chin, staring at him.
"Well," Perrin whispered hoarsely, "I opened it, but I'm not going to bloody carry you."
He looked hastily around the night-dark square. Still nothing moved, but he still had the feel of eyes watching.
"You are strong, Wetlander."
The Aiel did not move beyond working his shoulders.
"It took 3 men to hoist me up there. And now you bring me down. Why?"
"I don't like seeing people in cages," Perrin whispered. He wanted to go. The cage was open and those eyes were watching.
But the Aiel was not moving.
"If you do a thing, do it right. Will you get out of there before somebody comes?"
The Aiel grasped the frontmost overhead bar of the cage, heaved himself out and to his feet in one motion, then half hung there, supporting himself with his grip on the bar. He would have been nearly a head taller than Perrin, standing straight. He glanced at Perrin's eyes. Perrin knew how they must shine, burnished gold in the moonlight. But he did not mention them.
"I have been in there since yesterday, Wetlander."
He sounded like Lan. Not that their voices or accents were anything alike, but the Aiel had that same unruffled coolness, that same calm sureness.
"It will take a moment for my legs to work. I am Gaul of the Imran Sept of the Sharad Aiel, Wetlander. I am Shayan Emtal, a stone dog. My water is yours.
Well, I am Perrin Ebarra of the Two Rivers. I am a blacksmith."
The man was out of the cage. He could go now. Only if anyone came along before Gaul could walk, he would be right back into the cage unless they killed him, and either way would waste Perrin's work.
"If I had thought, I'd have brought a water bottle or a skin. Why do you call me Wetlander?"
Gaul gestured toward the river. Even Perrin's eyes could not be sure in the moonlight. But he thought the Aiel looked uneasy for the first time.
3 days ago, I watched a girl sporting in a huge pool of water. It must have been 20 paces across.
She pulled herself out into it.
He made an awkward swimming gesture with one hand.
A brave girl, crossing these rivers, has nearly unmanned me. I never thought there could be such a thing as too much water, but I never thought there was so much water in the world as you wetlanders have.
Perrin shook his head. He knew the Aiel waste held little water. It was one of the few things he knew about the waste or the Aiel. But he had not thought it could be scarce enough to cause this reaction.
You're a long way from home, Gaul. Why are you here?
We search, Gaul said slowly. We look for he who comes with the dawn.
Perrin had heard that name before, under circumstances that made him sure who it meant.
Light, it always comes back to Rand. I am tied to him like a mean horse for shoeing.
You are looking in the wrong direction, Gaul. I am looking for him too, and he is on his way to Tyr.
Tyr?
The Aiel sounded surprised.
Why?
But it must be.
Prophecy says when the stone of Tyr falls, we will leave the threefold land at last.
That was the Aiel name for the waste.
It says we will be changed, and find again what was ours and was lost.
That may be. I don't know your prophecies, Gaul.
Are you about ready to leave? Somebody could come any minute.
It is too late to run, Gaul said,
and a deep voice shouted, The savage is loose!
10 or a dozen white-cloaked men came running across the square, drawing swords, their conical helmets shining in the moonlight.
Children of the Light.
As if he had all the time in the world, Gaul calmly lifted a dark cloth from his shoulders and wrapped it around his head, finishing with a thick black veil that hid his face except for his eyes.
Do you like to dance, Perrin Ebarra? He asked.
With that, he darted away from the cage, straight at the oncoming white cloaks. For an instant, they were caught by surprise, but an instant was apparently all the Aiel needed. He kicked the sword out of the grip of the first to reach him. Then his stiffened hand struck like a dagger at the white cloak's throat, and he slid around the soldier as he fell. The next man's arm made a loud snap as Gaul broke it. He pushed that man under the feet of a third and kicked the fourth in the face. It was like a dance, from one to the next without stopping or slowing, though the tripped fellow was climbing back to his feet and the one with the broken arm had shifted his sword. Gaul danced on in the midst of them. Perrin had only an amazed moment himself, for not all the white cloaks had put their attentions on the Aiel. Barely in time, he gripped the axe haft with both hands to block a sword thrust, swung, and wanted to cry out as the half-moon blade tore the man's throat. But he had no time for crying out, none for regrets. More white cloaks followed before the first fell. He hated the gaping wounds the axe made, hated the way it chopped through mail to rend flesh beneath, split helmet and skull with almost equal ease. He hated it all. But he did not want to die. Time seemed to compress and stretch out, both at once. His body felt as if he fought for hours, and breath rasped raw in his throat. Men seemed to move as though floating through jelly. They seemed to leap in an instant from where they started to where they fell. Sweat rolled down his face, yet he felt as cold as quenching water. He fought for his life, and he could not have said whether it lasted seconds or all night. When he finally stood, panting and nearly stunned, looking at a dozen white-cloaked men lying on the paving blocks of the square, the moon appeared not to have moved at all. Some of the men groaned, others lay silent and still. Gaul stood among them, still veiled, still empty-handed. Most of the men down were his work. Perrin wished they all were and felt ashamed. The smell of blood and death was sharp and bitter.
You do not dance the spears badly, Perrin Ebarra.
Head spinning, Perrin muttered.
I don't see how 12 men fought 20 of you in one, even if 2 of them are hunters.
Is that what they say?
Gaul laughed softly.
Sarien and I were careless, being so long in these soft lands, and the wind was from the wrong direction, so we smelled nothing. We walked into them before we knew it. Well, Sarien is dead,
and I was caged like a fool. So perhaps we paid enough. It is time for running now, Wetlander. Tyr. I will remember it. At last he lowered the black veil. May you always find water and shade, Perrin Ebarra. Turning, he ran into the night. Perrin started to run, too, then realized he had a bloody axe in his hands. Hastily, he wiped the curved blade on a dead man's cloak. He's dead, burn me, and there's blood on it already. He made himself put the haft back through the loop on his belt before he broke into a trot. At his second step, he saw her, a slim shape at the edge of the square in dark, narrow skirts. She turned to run. He could see they were divided for riding. She darted back into the street and vanished. Lan met him before he reached the place where she had been standing. The warder took in the cage sitting empty beneath the gibbet, the shadowed white mounds that caught the moonlight, and he tossed his head as if he were about to erupt. In a voice as tight and hard as a new wheel rim, he said, "Is this your work, blacksmith? The light burned me. Is there anyone who can connect it to you?" "A girl," Perrin said. "I think she saw. I don't want you to hurt her, Lan. Plenty of others could have seen, too. There are lighted windows all around." The warder grabbed Perrin's coat sleeve and gave him a push toward the inn. "I saw a girl running, but I thought, no matter. You dig the Ogier out and haul him down to the stable. After this, we need to get our horses to the docks as quickly as possible. The light alone knows if there is a ship sailing tonight, or what I'll have to pay to hire one if there isn't. Don't ask questions, blacksmith. Do it. Run!"
Chapter 35. The Falcon. The warder's long legs outdistanced Perrin's, and by the time he pushed through the throng outside the inn doors, Lan was already striding up the stairs, not seeming in any particular hurry. Perrin made himself walk as slowly. From the doorway behind him came grumbles about people pushing ahead of other people.
"Again," Orban was saying, holding his silver cup up to be refilled.
"Aye, very well. They lay in ambush close beside the road we traveled, and an ambush I did not expect so close to Remen. Screaming, they rushed upon us from the crowding brush. In a breath, they were in our midst, their spears stabbing, slaying two of my best men and one of Gon's immediately. I knew Aiel when I saw them, and—"
Perrin hurried up the stairs.
"Well, Orban knows them now."
Voices came from behind Moraine's door. He did not want to hear what she had to say about this. He hurried past to stick his head into Loyal's room. The Ogier bed was a low, massive thing, twice as long and half as wide as any human bed Perrin had ever seen. It took up much of the room, and that was as large and as fine as Moraine's. Perrin vaguely remembered Loyal saying something about it being sungwood, and at any other time you might have stopped to admire those flowing curves that made it seem as if the bed had somehow grown where it stood. Ogier really must have stopped in Remen at some time in the past, for the innkeeper had also found a wooden chair that fit Loyal and filled it with cushions. The Ogier was comfortably sitting on them in his shirt and breeches, idly scratching a bare ankle with a toenail as he wrote in a large cloth-bound book on an arm of the chair.
"We're leaving," Perrin said.
Loyal gave a jump, nearly upsetting his ink bottle and almost dropping the book.
"Leaving? We only just arrived," he rumbled.
"Yes, leaving. Meet us at the stable as quickly as you can. And don't let anyone see you go. I think there's a back stair that runs down by the kitchen."
The smell of food at his end of the hall had been too strong for there not to be. The Ogier gave one regretful look at the bed, then started tugging on his high boots.
"But why?"
"The white cloaks," Perrin said. "I'll tell you more later."
He ducked back out before Loyal could ask any more. He had not unpacked. Once he had belted on his quiver, slung his cloak around him, tossed blanket roll and saddlebags on his shoulder, and picked up his bow, there was no sign he'd ever been there. Not a wrinkle in the folded blankets at the foot of the bed, not a splash of water in the cracked basin on the washstand. Even the tallow candle still had a fresh wick, he realized.
"I must have known I would not be staying. I don't seem to leave any mark behind me of late." As he suspected, a narrow stair at the back led down to a hall that ran out past the kitchen. He peered cautiously into the kitchen. A spit dog trotted in his big wicker wheel, turning a long spit that held a haunch of lamb, a large piece of beef, 5 chickens, and a goose. Fragrant steam rose from a soup cauldron hanging from a sturdy crane,